worshiping the self, trying to preserve the self, these efforts are somewhat like a cat that chases its tail, because no one has the capacity to preserve her life, or even to please herself for more than a short period of time. It is all a lie, this journey of the self.
That's the very Reverend Kate Moorhead, and today she brings you a powerful message entitled Self Giveaway. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to have with us the very Reverend Catherine Bingham Moorhead, the 10th Dean of St. John's Episcopal Cathedral in Jacksonville, Florida. Kate is the author of 5 seasonal meditation books. Her latest book just out is entitled Healed, How Mary Magdalene Was Made Well, a biblical and theological perspective on mental illness. Kate is a graduate of Vassar College, where she was given the Sarah Catlin Award for Religious Leadership, and Virginia Theological Seminary, where she received the Harris Award for Academic Excellence and Leadership Ability. She was also a Carpenter Scholar at Yale School of Divinity. Kate, welcome to Day One.
Thank you.
St. John's Cathedral sits in the heart of downtown Jacksonville. Paint a picture for us of what happens there during a typical week, if there is such a thing.
A typical week at the cathedral is very, very busy. It's a big place. We're surrounded by a lot of urban blight. We have a homeless shelter that's very large close by. We have about 634 apartments, low-income apartments for the elderly, and then a large congregation that hails from about 23 different zip codes. So we've got we actually even run a restaurant on Fridays that is teaches people who've been incarcerated or homeless how to be chefs and waiters, and then they run a gourmet restaurant called Clara's at the cathedral. So every day there are various outreach programs going on. There may be a Bible study. There's services almost every day of the week. Hopefully lots of youth running around and people needing help as people offering help. It's a blessed and busy place.
The cathedral has birthed a number of nonprofit organizations to meet particular needs there, and you are involved in leadership for several of them. Share some of those with us and how they are making a difference.
Over the decades, the cathedral has spun off 6 different nonprofit organizations, and we've remained very tied to them. So I'm vice president of those 6 boards. We have a large school that's grades 6 through 12, Episcopal School of Jacksonville. We have a preschool and early learning center. But we also have things like Aging True, which cares for the elderly and runs a Meals on Wheels program all over the city. And we have a program called the Cathedral Arts Project that teaches art, music, and dance to kids in the public school systems all over the city, about 2,000 kids a year. So a lot of great programs are going on. We have a nursing home, and we have a new nonprofit called Cathedral District Jacks that is trying to do urban development in our neighborhood in order to reinvigorate our neighborhood while still embracing the poor and taking care of them.
You were the author of a number of seasonal meditation books, but I wanted to ask you about your latest, just out from Church Publishing. It's called Healed, How Mary Magdalene Was Made Well. It's a biblical and theological perspective on mental illness, but explain how you make that connection between Mary and mental illness.
Well, Mary Magdalene has been misunderstood for hundreds and hundreds of years, really thousands of years. She has been, by popular Christian culture, always known as a prostitute, but there's actually no word for prostitute in the Gospels in the ancient Greek. So I was curious about her for many years and had been running women's retreats on her and did a lot of scholarship on her myself. What it does say in the scriptures themselves about Mary Magdalene is that she had 7 demons. And the demonic in the time of Jesus was a very broad concept. It was basically when someone did things that no one could explain. Like if they started beating themselves with rocks or cutting themselves or talking to things they couldn't see, or maybe someone who is an epileptic and just had seizures. So it ranged from physical ailments, but it definitely encompassed a lot of severe mental illness as well. So I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that because Mary Magdalene had seven different demons, that she was pretty ill. And if we look at other demoniacs, they tended to be ostracized, kind of like the lepers. They would have been homeless. People were worried that the demons were catching, so they would ostracize them. So not only would she not have been a prostitute, she never would have had the capacity to make money that way. But also, most likely, she might have been raped, most likely, yes, but probably just outcast. And the miracle of her story is that she goes from this very ill woman to one of the greatest disciples. And so the book is about a real search about what are demons, because I believe demons in the scripture are really temptation, and all of us have them. And all of us have mental illness. It's really more of a trajectory than it is a black and white issue. We all have things that we contend with, no matter how functional we are, anxiety or maybe a little sadness, maybe grief. So examining what are demons and how can we know our own demons is part of the book. Then the other part of the book is looking at Mary Magdalene's behavior after she was healed, because she models what it is to be spiritually and psychologically well. And I think she really is a bridge or a saint for those who struggle with mental illness, because she shows us all how to be well. I think we should treat mental health a little bit more like physical health. We go to the doctor once a year, we get a checkup, and the doctor never says you're perfect. The same with mental illness. I think we all have things that we need to work on. None of us is just completely well. So this is a book really for everyone. But it was particularly born of the fact that there was a young woman in my first congregation when I was a young priest, and she was very mentally ill. She had been abused and raped as a little girl, and I became very close to her, and a couple of years before I began writing the book, she actually killed herself. She hung herself in an apartment in South Carolina. And I think part of this book was written by me as a chance to lift her up and bring hope to people who struggle in that way.
Mental health is a critical issue today, and more than ever, it seems that available programs are getting cut or shut down, offered by government or other agencies. So how can the church play a role in serving those dealing with these issues?
That's a great question. You know, for so long, and I think it was initiated by Freud, but there's been a kind of a divorce between the faith communities and the mental health communities. I think Freud sort of instilled this basic premise that religion was a kind of neurosis. And by no means do most mental health professionals think that today, but there is still this sense of some kind of either competition or animosity between the two fields. But we really should be united as one. God gives us doctors. God gives us psychiatrists. I think that when we are looking at mental health issues, it's often the faith community that will sense them first, that will say, wait, this person has lived in our community for a decade, but now this person's acting strange. It's often the priest that can be that person that refers onto a good therapist or psychiatrist. It's also really important, though, for priests like me to not think we're therapists, because we really don't have that kind of adequate training. So it's important that we rely on and refer to good therapists. I actually have a file of good therapists, but I value the profession very much. Yeah.
Well, this Sunday is the second in the season of Lent, and your sermon draws on both Genesis chapter 17, the story of God's covenant with Abram, and Mark chapter 8. Would you read them for us?
Yes, I'd be glad to. A reading from the book of Genesis. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you and will make you exceedingly numerous. Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the ancestor of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your offspring after you throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. God said to Abraham, As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of people shall come from her. The word of the Lord. A reading from the Gospel according to Mark. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering, and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Kate, your sermon is entitled Self-Giveaway. We look forward to hearing it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to listen again to today's program or read or share a transcript of Dean Kate Moorhead's sermon, visit our website at dayone.org. Or for a free printed sermon transcript, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1.
Rebecca had a baby girl just as the Nazis invaded Poland. As the soldiers marched into Warsaw, she clutched her baby girl to her chest in desperation. Rebecca was Jewish. Her husband was a professor. They were too smart for their own good, and they were reading the signs. She and her family knew that the Nazis hated them. As tensions arose, Rebecca and her husband began to make plans for her baby girl. Her best friend from grammar school was a Christian. She had recently married and they had not yet had children. Rebecca went by night out of the Jewish ghetto with her baby to visit her friend and to ask her the most important question of her life. Will you take my baby girl? Will you raise her as your own? I am afraid for my life and the life of my people. I am afraid that she will be taken from me. Will you be her mother? The conversation lasted long into the night. Her friend did not believe that this was necessary. It was not that she did not want the baby. She did, but she was afraid that Rebecca would later regret her decision. Rebecca was adamant, and she finally convinced her friend. And so it came to be that a woman handed over her child so that the child might live. Rebecca's baby girl survived the Holocaust disguised as a Christian, and she still lives today. When Abram was asked to follow God, he was asked to give up life as he knew it. He had to give up his name. He had to leave his country. He had to abandon his ancestors and their gods. And he had to walk out into a new life, trusting that God would provide for him. Have you ever tried to get an elderly person to move houses, let alone move to another neighborhood? The old don't like change, and Abram was old. If you agree to follow me, God said to Abram, if you let go of everything you know, I will make you the father of many nations. You will be the ancestor of kings, the source of whole races of people, the beginning of a new kind of humanity. But in order to gain all of this, you have to give up on yourself, on all your ideas about who you are and who you serve. In order to let God change his life, Abram had to let go of who he was and be willing to let God make him anew. When Jesus tells Peter that he's going to die, Peter will not hear it. That can't happen to you, Lord, not to you. And Jesus is more stern with Peter in this moment than he is at any other time. Even when Peter returns to the resurrected Christ, after having betrayed him 3 times, Jesus does not chastise him then as he does now. Get behind me, Satan, Jesus says. You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. Peter sees Jesus as a person who must be about his own survival. The most important thing is for Jesus to stay alive. There is nothing more important than preserving his life. What Peter does not understand is that fear and the works of darkness all stem from this crucial understanding that we must preserve ourselves at all costs. It is the devil who tempts us to believe that there is nothing more than this life, and that we must do all that we can to preserve our existence. It is the darkness that first and foremost wants us consumed with our own survival. The forces of darkness want us consumed with me, myself and I, and holding tightly to the lie that survival is the most important aspect of life on this earth. This fear is based on the assumption that there is nothing after death, and so death must be avoided at all costs. Just keep things the same, and everything will be okay. Don't give your life away. This belief that we must survive leads us to begin to live our lives with ourselves at the center. If preserving your life is the most important thing, then one can easily become consumed with what the body or mind need to keep on going. This quickly can morph into self-centeredness. Pleasing the self becomes of the utmost importance. What I like, what I love, what I want to buy or consume or experience becomes essential. Thus begins the never-ending journey of chasing a shadow. Worshipping the self trying to preserve the self, these efforts are somewhat like a cat that chases its tail, because no one has the capacity to preserve her life, or even to please herself for more than a short period of time. It is all a lie, this journey of the self. For the self has no power at all, and the death rate is still 100%. Jesus instead offers us another model for devotion. Don't worship yourself, he says. Don't spend all your time trying to fix yourself or please yourself or just stay alive, but instead, give your life away. Hand it over to God. Lose yourself, and you will find yourself. Take up your cross, and in following Christ, you will find out who you truly are. This is really hard to do, to lose yourself, to give your life to God. It is just as hard for us as it was for Rebecca to hand her baby off to another. It goes against all our instincts. But Rebecca did it because she knew that her life was doomed. It ended in nothing. She knew that the only hope for her daughter was to give her away. There will come a time when you have tried enough to please yourself. It happens naturally to good people. You will realize that there is nothing more that you can buy, nothing more that you can eat, and no place that you can travel that will truly fill your soul. These things can be fun, but they don't last. Only love lasts. And love only happens when we are able to put someone else ahead of ourselves. So when you come to that moment when you are ready to hand the baby over, to hand your life over to God, take it in slow steps. Give God some of your time. Give God some of your money. Give God some of your deepest, most intimate thoughts, and let God fill in the empty spaces. Those who save their lives will lose them, Jesus said, and those who lose their lives will save them. God is love, and God will not enter a soul that is full of itself. A teacup full of tea can take no more. If you are full of yourself, God will wait until you can empty yourself and make room. God will wait a long time. Amen.
Our Day One preacher today was the Very Reverend Kate Moorhead, Dean of St. John's Episcopal Cathedral in Jacksonville, Florida. Her message for the second Sunday in Lent is entitled Self-Giveaway. For a free printed transcript, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-3291. Or write to us at Day One, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week, we're honored to welcome the Reverend Dr. Walter Brueggemann, Professor Emeritus of Old Testament at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. His sermon for the third Sunday in Lent is entitled Strategies for Staying Emancipated. Be sure to tune in for his inspiring message.
Thank you.
Now, Kate Moorhead offers some final reflections on today's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Kate, sometimes I think we don't realize how huge God's call to Abraham would have been. You said Abram was asked to give up life as he knew it, his name, his land, his ancestors, and God's, and that's not easy at any age, let alone how old Abram was. Yet God promises that should Abram obey, the blessings would be infinite. We hear the same promises as followers of Christ, but do you think we always reckon with the costs of truly following Jesus?
No, I don't think we can reckon with those costs. It's so hard for us to change. It's so hard for us to let go. That's why at the very end of the sermon, I suggest that you take it in steps, because I think the human mind has difficulty releasing and trusting. And so the best way to begin is through practice. Practice of letting go of some of our time and giving that to God, and the practice of giving money away is really important in the devotional life. We've got to sort of practice releasing, letting go, unclenching our fists, so to speak. And sometimes it's easier to do that in small increments.
And in the same way, Peter challenges Jesus because he can't fathom Jesus dying. Jesus tells him he is setting his mind on human, not divine things. And you said what Peter doesn't understand is that fear and the works of darkness all stem from the belief that we must preserve ourselves at all costs. And that's the devil's temptation. So no need to give our lives away. But what happens to us when we give in to that temptation?
Well, I think it's a downward spiral. The more afraid we become, the smaller our lives become. And the eventual reality is that the darkness wants to annihilate us, and fear is a mechanism of doing that. You know, be careful, be smaller, get smaller, be cautious, don't live your life fully. It's really a process at which we become less and less alive, because life involves change, and comfort is, in a way, a kind of falling asleep. So fear wants us asleep and eventually nothing. So it's very painful to be fully awake and fully alive and to change and grow. And I must say, I mean, I have not mastered this at all. We all struggle with this. But I think to the extent that we can push ourselves through a bit of fear every day, try something new, try something different, that's healthy. That helps our soul expand and to expand and ask ourselves, what is God asking of me today? And maybe what God is asking is something very different than from yesterday.
Jesus offers another model for devotion. You said, give your life away, hand it over to God, lose yourself, and you will find yourself. Take up your cross, and in following Christ, you will find out who you really are. This is hard to do, you said, so how do we do it?
Well, one of the keys, I believe, is identifying your cross. So the cross for us is the crux of our suffering. So, for example, we have a couple in our congregation whose son at 28 overdosed from heroin. What a horrible, horrible cross. But they have no choice but to stand up and begin to speak about him. So the first thing that they're going to begin to do is talk to our youth group about drugs. And they need to lift up that pain and make new life from it. And it's a really hard journey. Now, for many of us who haven't had such a tragedy in our lives, it's a little harder to identify that cross. But I think the key is to look upon our lives and to think about, where is our struggle? Where is that hook where we had to learn something? And how can we take that and turn it into some kind of new birth?
Kate, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind in the days ahead?
I think that the process of learning to let go of the self is a lifelong process. And it's very difficult because our culture is so self-oriented. So we're basically being told constantly through billboards and ads that we should be about ourselves. We should be buying things, thinking about our own retirement, how attractive we are physically. So it's essential that we begin to counteract those cultural voices by practicing the basics of the Christian faith. And it's interesting, in this post-Christian world, we don't stress these basic Christian practices as much as we should, I think. But as a believer, of any denomination, I think it's really important to take 20 minutes in prayer every day. I think it's really important to work towards tithing your income to church or to anything that's of God's purposes, to serve the poor, not just to write a check, but to face them and look at them in the eyes regularly, to worship. I mean, I'm still one of those people that believes in weekly worship in church, and even satelliting, which we do at the cathedral, should be only for those who are really sick or old. I really believe in that face-to-face incarnational worship. And if you practice these things, though, the self will begin to let go. And it's not that life is easy, but there's this joy to it that is so profound. And I wouldn't trade it for the world. It's the best recipe. I just wish we could somehow get this into a commercial or a soundbite, but I don't think the gospel will be condensed that much. So,
Kate Moorhead, thank you for being with us, and we look forward to having you back in 6 weeks.
Thank you.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.